Hello, I'm your host, Erin Gruwell, and welcome to the Freedom Writers Podcast. Today's show is my conversation with model, author, and body positivity activist, Tess Holliday. We discuss her journey from overcoming obstacles in a small town in Mississippi to strutting down runways across the world as a professional model. Tess's story proves that through determination and self-love, that you can accomplish anything. Tess continues to fight for inclusion and diversity in the world of fashion, and I hope that our conversation will leave you feeling enlightened and empowered to make a difference. When the Freedom Writers entered my classroom, bullying looked very different than it does today. For many of my students, Room 203 acted as their safe haven, a place to feel accepted. However, for many students today, there sadly is no escape from this horrific onslaught, either in person or online. Since the rise of the internet, many students have felt trapped in a relentless cycle of bullying, both at school and at home. Unfortunately, as cyberbullying has become an increasingly prominent issue, students have lacked a guide to help them combat this persistent problem. Today's guest, Tess Holliday, is the living embodiment of perseverance and grit in the face of such adversity. As a self-proclaimed plus-size model, she has graced the covers of magazines of Cosmopolitan, Self, and People, and became one of the first plus-size models to sign with a major modeling agency. Throughout her professional career, Tess has remained an ardent activist, working to ensure everybody feels beautiful, no matter their size, shape, or circumstance. In 2013, Tess started the hashtag F Your Beauty Standards movement to give a voice to those who felt excluded from the fashion industry's version of the ideal body. In her memoir entitled, The Not-So-Subtle Art of Being a Fat Girl, Loving the Skin You're In, Tess explores her passion for body positivity, acceptance, and compassion, and the things that energize her to fight for the bullied, challenge societal norms about models, and say F your beauty standards. Without further ado, here is my courageous conversation with Tess Holliday. I am so excited to talk about a subject that needs to be discussed in schools, classrooms, our homes, around dinner tables with our friends and family. And that is self-image, self-awareness, body positivity. So when I think about our guest, she is the perfect person to invite into that classroom, into that school, around that dinner table with friends and family, and to have a discussion about what self-awareness, self-esteem, and body positivity is. So I'd love to welcome to our podcast, Tess Holliday. Welcome.
Thanks for having me.
I'm jealous, first and foremost, that you're doing our podcast because your podcast sounds more fun. You invite your guests to come over in their pajamas.
I do. I think I need to probably put parameters on what pajamas look like and can mean because everyone, you know, sleeps in attire differently. But I'm really excited to start doing it and having my guests show up. When my last guest showed up in like fluffy white bunny slippers and like this cute little get up, but she was like walking down Sunset Boulevard in her pajamas. And I said, like, Ashley, you could have switched in the bathroom. And she's like, oh, I'm sorry. I just showed up in my pajamas. So yeah, it's been fun so far.
I have a lion onesie.
That would work. Okay. Yeah, you're invited.
I'll traipse down the street in my lion onesie. So before you had a podcast, before you were traipsing down runways across the world, before you were a best-selling author, you were a kid, and there's going to be a lot of kids listening to this podcast. So what was 10-year-old Tess like?
I was not as cool as the kids now because TikTok and YouTube and Instagram wasn't a thing. I was really goofy, still am, shy. I loved playing in the woods with, you know, a backpack full of snacks and toys and disappearing. I didn't have a ton of friends because I moved around a lot when I was younger, and I got bullied a lot in school, so I kept to myself mostly, and my brother and I did not get along like most siblings when you're growing up. So I just spent a lot of time in the woods, you know, listening to Alanis Morissette and crying.
I wish our listeners could see what I see. You have the most beautiful, like, alabaster skin.
Thank you.
And almost like, I read one reporter compared your hair to Jessica Rabbit, but with better conditioner. So you've got this beautiful fire engine red hair. Did you find that the kids in Louisiana just did not see what clearly I am seeing or the rest of the world is seeing?
Well, I didn't see that. You know, that was the first issue. My mom was really great at instilling, you know, you can be whoever you want to be. You know, if you want to color your hair crazy hair colors, you can do that. However, the rest of my family was not that way. And also my mom, you know, she did the best she could growing up in, you know, the rural South. But it was really tough for me because I call myself fat. It's an adjective that I use to describe myself, and it doesn't bother me. It's just a word. But at the time, I was fat and I did not love being fat. I didn't like being plus size and I didn't love my body. So whatever I could do to just kind of be the funny kid and, you know, I didn't really focus on my looks. I tried, but I in no way, shape, or form considered myself attractive until much, much later in life. I was too busy kind of trying to blend in. And if people noticed me, then I was trying to make them laugh.
I want to stop and dissect words. You know, as an English teacher, I'm always so drawn to the power of words, positive and negative. Mm-hmm. And I hate that teachers and parents and anyone with authority doesn't correct kids when they say horrific words that hurt.
Absolutely.
And sting and stay with you. And so I remember when I first began teaching, there was PHAT, fat farm.
Yes.
And I think people try to take that word
and
to make it something different. It reminds me of Michael Jackson's Bad is Really Good. Mm-hmm. But the word FAT for me is a word that I never use. I had to spell it because I don't even like using it. So I don't like to use it and I don't like to hear it. What's that like to be a kid and have it be directed at you?
I mean, it's different when you're growing up. I mean, I think now kids, you know, depending on your household, have a lot of access to people that exist in larger bodies on screen in positive ways. Like, you know, you have myself, you have Lizzo, there's, you know, you have a ton of male actors, but I'm not going to get into the politics of that because no one can. Kids don't, you know, it's too much. But there's more positive representation. But when I was a kid, that you didn't see, you know, really anyone that was in a larger body that was in mainstream media in a positive way. So I felt really lonely. I felt like an outcast. And, you know, growing up down south, a lot of people are big. You know, we're a big group of people down south. And I still didn't feel like I fit in. So it was quite hard. I dealt with a lot of depression. I've been in therapy. Thank goodness my mom put me in therapy at the age of 10. So I've been in therapy for 25 years. And I'm really grateful that she listened to me because at school, I had no support, which is why I ended up dropping out later and getting my education on my own.
When I first met my Freedom Writers, there was one student in particular who said that he never said where he lived. He said where I stay at. And by the time he was in my class, he'd already been to 42 foster homes. Mm-hmm. And I had heard that you had been to 40 different places by the time you were 10. So what's that like when you're constantly moving, constantly on the go?
It's very difficult to make friends. It's very difficult to have a sense of who you are and what you like. And you don't realize how difficult it is to be so young and not be able to make connections with kids your age. So I grew up in an abusive household, so I was dealing with the abuse, but I was also dealing with not understanding how to make friends and how to connect with people my age, because, you know, I wasn't living in their area. I had just moved from usually a different state or a different city. And so I was constantly having to kind of reinvent myself. So I feel like I didn't really know who I was much later in life. But yeah, I didn't really have many friends. You know, I didn't know how to make friends, which is unfortunate, but I'm really grateful now that I have a lot of really cool people in my life.
And you're so loyal to your friends. I love that.
I am. They're stuck with me forever.
I love that. When my Freedomers showed up, there was a lot of, I think, invisible scars. You know, there was a lot of verbal abuse and physical abuse, and for many of my Freedomers, sexual abuse. So I know that you said that your father was verbally abusive, and for a lot of people, the verbal abuse is the hardest to shake because you hear it echoing in your head. Has that been hard to kind of wrap your head around the fact that there's not physical scars, but there's that PTSD and emotional trauma?
My dad was verbally, mentally, and physically abusive my entire life. But like you said, the verbal and mental things that are said to you stick and they stay with you. And trauma, it's not like you kind of work through trauma and then, at least in my experience, you're done. It comes up at different parts of your life in times that you don't want it to, in ways that you're not expecting or anticipating. And for me, you know, I heard my dad tell me, you know, you're too fat to do this, or you're not good enough to do this. And, you know, he was quite complimentary in some ways, mostly about my appearance, but that was when I was much younger and didn't really understand, you know, the levels of abuse and things like that. And now that I'm a parent myself, you know, I have a teenage son and I have a toddler, I'm really mindful of my language that I use with them. And I'm really mindful that, you know, when I get mad, not to react in a way, you know, that my dad would have done. So in some ways, I'm grateful that I went through all of that with my dad, because it made me a much more mindful human and kinder to myself and to others. And hopefully, you know, it can help change the future generations, you know, hopefully, fingers crossed.
I'm sad that we're not in pajamas. And I'm also sad that we are not favorite place in the world, which is Disneyland. Yeah, so that's like your escape. Yes. And I love the metaphor of what Disneyland is, you know, the happiest place on earth. So when you are that 10-year-old kid moving and hearing and seeing things you shouldn't see, something really inexplicable and tragic happened to your mom. So what was that like to be a witness to the domestic violence that your mom went through that almost took her life?
Yeah. So when I was 10, well, it was a month before my 10th birthday, my future stepfather shot my mom in the head twice and then left her in the bathtub to go to work. And then, you know, 6 hours later was found and was in a coma for over a month. And then she learned how to walk and talk and, you know, still annoys me to this day. So I would be lost without my mom. And that's part of why I've been in therapy since I was 10. My mom was, you know, a victim of domestic violence and then has spent her life campaigning for victims' rights. And, you know, it was a world. My life was not perfect. You know, I had a very tumultuous household, but it wasn't until, you know, my mom almost died that a lot of stuff just came up in me. Like, you know, I was dealing with facing losing the only stability that I had, but I just dealt with stuff a lot differently. You see the world a lot differently. Things are much more precious, and I developed anxiety, but I have always tried to, you know, despite what I've gone through, look at the other side. And like I've said a few times already, I'm grateful that I went through all of that with my mom, because it helped shape me into who I am. But it really sucked. it was lonely. I was angry. I was sad. And yeah, it sucked.
I love that you said sucked.
Yeah.
Because I think sometimes kids just need to hear that, that things suck.
Yeah.
But when you see you, you're so positive. You even, when you walked in the room, you even smell really good. Like, it's just the whole room.
Well, that's just Gucci.
Smells like me. You.
I have nothing to do with that.
If it wasn't COVID, I would give you a big bear hug and then I would smell like yes. you. So I'm hoping it just lingers in the air. But everything about you, to me, radiates. Like joy and positivity. And I love that any kind of pain, and every kind of pain, is now your purpose. And so you get to have the weight of the world on your shoulder to say, it gets better. Mm-hmm. And most of that, it gets better, is because of you. So internally, you've got this fighting spirit. Where do you think that came from? To fight for your own education, to fight to leave that small town, to continue fighting for your mom who was paralyzed. Mm-hmm. Where does that inner fighting spirit come from?
I mean, I typically credit my mom, because my mom, you know, I don't take relationship advice from my mom. However, my mom is very stubborn and very resilient, and she always encouraged me, even if she did not agree with what I was doing. And let me tell you, she usually does not agree with like 75% of the things that I do. And we clash. But even as a kid, she just always encouraged me to go after what I wanted. And I reference the movie Big Fish a lot. I talk about it in my book, and then, you know, just now, obviously. But that movie really reminded me that it's okay that I don't fit in like the small town, that I was meant for something bigger. I just didn't know what bigger looked like. And it was not easy, but I knew that obviously there was something bigger for me. I just didn't know what it looked like. And it was not easy, and it was extremely hard. But, you know, seeing everything that my mom went through, you know, I tell people now, I wanted to be a model so badly. I didn't know that it would develop into the activism that it's taken on. But I truly believe that that was, the modeling was just a tool to get me to the work that I do now. But yeah, thank goodness that, you know, my mom encouraged me, because I wouldn't have done any of it.
I want to go backwards to that little girl. After your mom was shot, I know that you live with your grandparents. And then at one point you were living in a trailer. Mm-hmm. And so many of the kids that we serve have very humble roots like you. They may not have the house with a white picket fence. They may live with a relative or even a foster parent. And I love that this young fighter in you decided that you were going to take your dreams. You went to the other side of the world. You went to Seattle to first pursue this dream of being an artist. Using makeup and creating beautiful art on others. Now you get to create it on yourself.
I do.
But what was that like to first leave home? I think you were 17 or 18 years old.
Yeah.
And move across the country and pursue a dream that was the first step of a much larger dream.
Well, I had met my friend who's now my longest friend, but you know, we were 17. I met her at Waffle House in Mississippi, And she said, hey, you know, I live in Seattle, Washington, like you should come check it out. And I was, you know, I was like this young little punk rock kid in Mississippi. And I thought I was punk rock, but I mean, the music I was listening to was not punk. It's just like I was in Mississippi, so I didn't know any better. But I had like, you know, my dark makeup and my big black pants. I was angry. And I was like, sure, I'll go visit you in Seattle, Washington. And I get on the airplane and I swear I thought that I was going to Washington, D.C. I didn't know that there was a Washington state, but, you know, Mississippi education. I'm sure it's great now. But at the time I went to high school in an old Walmart building. So it's not my fault. So I end up in Seattle, Washington. And I just remember it was the first time in my life I felt at home because I wasn't like the weird one. There were people so much weirder than me and nobody cared. And I felt like I could breathe. And so I visited and I went back and I told my mom I'm moving. She was really, really mad at me. She didn't talk to me for a little bit. You know, and ultimately I was only there for a year before I got pregnant and had to move back to Mississippi. And then obviously I went back to Seattle. But it was really exciting for me and transformative. I had no idea what I was doing. I lived on a bunch of my friends' couches, a bunch of my friends' moms. Thank goodness I had a good personality because they took me in. it was really rough, but I've just always been the kind of person that, you know, how do you know something's not possible unless you try and unless you make it happen? And I never take no for an answer. And, you know, that time in my life taught me so much and it showed me that I was capable of a lot more. And that's, you know, where my love of makeup came. And, you know, I believe that there's no such thing as coincidences. And, you know, I believe in divine timing and, you know, there's a reason why I went there when I did and ended up here on the path that I'm on. So
I love that we're now neighbors. We live in the same city.
I'll bring you fried chicken.
We are never home. Besides COVID, we're stuck here now.
Yes.
But Tess and I travel the world, have more frequent flyer miles than we know what to do with.
Yes.
But I love that you made your way to California. Mm. And when you came here, did you think this was the land of dreams?
No.
Did you come here thinking that I'm going to be on the cover of magazines, I'm gonna be walking runways, I'm gonna be an author? Or did you just come to California once again to start anew?
I met this guy, fell in love. You know, he has now adopted my older son. My older son's biological father is not in the picture. And so I met this guy who was a great guy. And I moved here to be with him. And shortly after I moved here, neither one of us wanted to be with each other. But within 6 months of me moving, you know, I had an agent find me online and ask me to come in for an audition. I thought that it was a scam, but they had snacks, so I stayed. And, you know,
That's the name of a chapter. They had snacks, so I stayed.
I put some snacks in my purse. I was so excited. I was like, are these free? And, yeah, I still do that, actually, now when I'm on a set. I steal snacks. But Julia Roberts did it, too. So I feel like if Julia Roberts can clean out a green room the day before me, then I can, too. So anyway, that's a story for another time. But I was like, if Julia Roberts can steal all this kettle corn, I can, too. I moved here to get married. But I started modeling, and I realized very soon into modeling and sharing my experiences of what it was like to model at the time when no one looked like me, that there was something much bigger than just me wanting to model there.
I love that you love love. Like, you love love. And I think that your love for other people has really actualized in your love for yourself. So you are trailblazing.
I never thought of that before.
And but I love that you, because you emanated. I mean, it's coming out of your pores. But I love that suddenly you realize I'm following my dreams And you entered an industry that is intimidating. I don't have the courage to model. I personally don't deal well with rejection or catwalks. So to be able to enter an industry that has this script of how everyone should look, cookie cutter and carbon copy, I love that you went rogue and you're a maverick and you said, F that. So where did that come from? That little girl with all that purpose and all that passion, how did you realize I'm going to change an industry and I'm going to crash down a glass ceiling?
I mean, I definitely did not go into all of it thinking that I was going to change an entire industry. I mean, I've been doing this for a little over 10 years now, and I started very late. Most of my colleagues that, you know, were models had started 10 years before me, you know, when they were teenagers. And here I am, you know, at the time I was 24, 25 and starting to model. So I was quite old by those standards and very inexperienced. But I always told myself, you know, if my mom can survive being shot in the head twice, you know, and go through everything that she went through, then why is it so ridiculous if someone that's, you know, 5'4" and a size US 22, why is that ridiculous that I can't be a model, you know? So I thought, you know, gonna try. What's the worst? So I fail, then I fail, you know? And it, you know, like I said, it became quite evident that there was a need for it. And it's funny because now I can look back and the industry has changed so much, but there's still so much work to be done that I can't even, like, I sometimes think about it, but then if I do, I get too overwhelmed because I'm not happy yet. There's still more that needs to be done. But look, if I died today, I'm extremely grateful for everything that I have had.
Well, you're not going anywhere.
I'm not.
You're not going anywhere. And you have gone
not anytime
from
soon.
Being a model to really being an activist. And I'd like to talk about your hashtag that went viral, Change the World, your best friend Deborah sitting next to you wearing your hashtag and your face
literally
on her
over.
T-shirt.
You're embarrassing me. So, no, I'm just kidding.
So tell our listeners what that famous hashtag is and how it just literally took off. And it's in the millions, the multi-millions by now. So tell us, what encouraged you to create that hashtag?
I was frustrated. I was on Tumblr. Now I'm aging myself. So basically, you know, I was on social media. I didn't see anybody that looked like me. And I was extremely frustrated and sad. And I had a bunch of people telling me, well, you know, you're plus size. You shouldn't show your arms. You shouldn't wear a bathing suit. You know, you shouldn't wear stuff that basically shows that I have a body. And I thought, F that, you know, and I created a hashtag from my bed, posted it on Instagram. And I said, you know, if you're tired of society telling you what you should and shouldn't look like, how you should present yourself in the world, what you can dress because, you know, what you can wear because of your size, post a photo in something that scares you or something that empowers you and hashtag F your beauty standards. And it was the first body positive hashtag on Instagram that took off in the way that it did. And, you know, I wasn't expecting it, but at the same time, I wasn't surprised because there was such a need for, you know, self-love at that time and always, but we weren't really talking about it a decade ago. We weren't talking about, at least not in mainstream, that, you know, no matter how you identify, male, female, you know, other, we all deal with hating some parts of our bodies or not liking ourselves. And there's so much shame. And, you know, I almost killed myself many times because I did not fit in to some ridiculous standard that someone created that doesn't actually care about me. So why am I conforming to that? And once I realized that, I was much happier, and I gave myself permission to love how I look now instead of, you know, how I could look or what I would change or, you know, how I wish I looked when I was, you know, born. I just start embracing, you know, all of it.
I love the now, the loving now. And I love that this viral hashtag, F Your Body Standards, went around the globe. And I love the story you've told about that woman in Melbourne, you know, across the globe, took your viral hashtag and you helped her love herself. So share with our listeners how that beautiful story showed you could travel through cities and countries and continents and make such a big difference in the lives of women, parents, people who don't look like us or talk like us,
yeah,
but ultimately are us.
Yeah. So I was in Australia working, and I did an event where my fans, you know, followers from online could come and meet me. And there was a woman, and she was there with her son. And she pulled me aside. And when I meet my followers, I take time because they've waited in line. They're taking time. So even if it's just a hug, this was pre-COVID, you know. But I would take the time to talk to them. And she shared with me that she had 2 children, and she had lost one of her sons suddenly. And she shared that when they went to do his memorial, she didn't really have any photos of her and her son together. There were photos of her and her son when he was younger, but none for at least a few years, because she hated the way she looked so much that she just refused to be in photos. And we both started crying, because as a mom, I understand that. But to see her so sad, knowing that those memories, you know, time is precious and none of us are promised tomorrow. And you know, she was devastated. But the silver lining to it was that she said, after finding me and a few other people from, you know, our community, she realized that she was good enough the way that she was beautiful. And so she said, because of you, I've started taking photos with my son. And she introduced me to her son. And she said, I never want that to happen again. You know, I want to create memories. And so she's like, I put a bathing suit on for the first time and we went to the beach. And you know, it's a moment that has stayed with me my entire life, because I can't imagine, you know, I can't imagine feeling like that. And knowing that it can impact one person, and that one person can go on to impact someone else, and it's a ripple effect, you know. So that's why I always say we all just need to, like, give a crap about each other a little bit more.
I love that. I love that image of this mom and her son. But I love the image of you with your 2 sons on a cover of a magazine.
Yeah.
Imagine that. You're this mom, and you are not just within the pages of a magazine. You are the cover gal. What was that like to be a proud mom on a cover of a magazine and showing your family and showing the best of you?
It was nice because Parents, you know, magazine hasn't put like a fat mom on a cover before. So being able to be on a cover, a fat tattooed mom, and we're often looked down upon, you know, especially moms, not just tattooed moms, but especially fat moms, because we're seen as not capable of doing a lot of things, that we don't care about our kids. There's all kinds of stigmas and stereotypes attached to being a plus size parent. And to be able to share that moment with my 2 sons was so amazing. And also my 14-year-old was more challenging at that shoot than my 4-year-old. So that was a lesson, because my 14-year-old always wanted to do some kind of, you know, acting or something like that. And after that, I was like, listen, you're so smart, but I don't think that you're meant for the spotlight. And we need you to change the world in other ways. Because he was like, my feet hurt. I'm hungry. And I'm like, you know, there's this table full of snacks and it's really fun. But I was like, you have to work. And then I promise I'll give you a snack. But it was a lot of fun. It was having that moment with them was great. But for me, it was the representation. It was the visibility, because that's what changes lives. It was knowing that hopefully, you know, another parent in whatever capacity that means, caregiver, could feel like they were seeing themselves, you know.
With you being on all of these covers, you were a Cosmo cover girl. You were on the cover of Parent Magazine with your own beautiful babies. What is it like in a world where people don't just revel and celebrate? And with great success, people sometimes try to pull people down. So mm-hmm. What is it like when you're riding this great high and then you get pushback or any kind of negativity? What does that feel like?
I have never done anything in my career that I was proud of that has not come with some form of, you know, criticism or people saying not nice things about me or to me. I think it's just part of, you know, people will say to me, well, you know, you knew when you were a celebrity what you were signing up for. And I'm like, well, that's not the case, because, you know, I definitely am treated differently because of my size versus other people. But at the same time, I try to remind myself that whoever is on the other side of that screen saying things to me that aren't very nice or diminishing my accomplishments or successes, that there's something that they need to work on, that they are unhappy. And I try to have compassion, because I know that it's probably not easy not liking yourself so much that you would go online and be mean to someone at a time when they're happy. It's like showing up to someone's birthday party and taking the cake away from them and being like, well, I had a birthday 6 months ago, you know? It's like, great, well, it's my birthday now. So it's tough, but, you know, and like I said earlier, it sucks, but I try to have compassion towards them, because I know that there have been times in my life where I definitely needed compassion from others when I was not being the kindest, because hurt people hurt people.
I like that saying, hurt people hurt people. And you were hurt, but you heal. And like we said, you love love.
Yeah.
So in the world of social media, I don't have a thick skin, so I don't have personal social media platforms myself. The so Freedom Writers do. So I think because I'd go down a rabbit hole. I don't have an Erin Gruwell Facebook page or an Erin Gruwell Twitter or Instagram. But in the world of trolls and clickbait, how do you navigate when you have such a robust following? What you're going to read and what you're not going to read? And how do you filter that?
You know, I've had a few friends that are famous that have been doing this for a really long time give me advice. And the thing that most everyone says that I have found true is that I try not to pay attention to the positive or negative. I'm very much just, you know, I have kind of blinders on and I'm very focused on what I'm doing. With that being said, yesterday I cried for at least an hour in my car because of mean things people said online. Because I'm a human being and I have days where it does get to me. I think the difference is when people are being mean to me online, I don't internalize those things. I'm able to say, I'm able to hear it, release it, and move on. And that's why I try to be very vocal about what I'm going through, what people say to me. Because I hope in some way it lets people feel like they're not alone. Like, hey, we're all going to have critics and people that maybe are not fans of us, no matter what we're doing, no matter if you're a celebrity or not, it's how you handle it and what you do with it that matters. So I just try my best not to internalize any of it. And as long as I'm happy, that's all I care about.
As a teacher of writing, I'm so giddy that you wrote a book, because I think that's the most cathartic thing that a person can do, especially someone that has had such a robust life like yourself. So I want to read the title, and I want everybody that's listening to purchase it.
Oh, God, it's the longest title.
The Not So Subtle Art of Being a Fat Girl, Loving the Skin You're In. I love the long title. So let's talk about this long title for your not so long life. Yes. And what that was like to sit down and be vulnerable and share with an audience things that are not just 140 characters in a tweet or just a brief picture they'd see on an Instagram. You bared your soul, and the reader's going to be able to bear witness. Mm. So when you sat down to take us back to that small town in Mississippi or all of your adventures, positive and negative, what was that like to put pen to paper?
Writing a book is so much harder than I thought it was going to be. I definitely went into it very naively. I have a ton of great stories. I'm very much a storyteller, not the shortest storyteller. I'm, you know, my stories go on for a very long time and take a lot of detours. And if you're still awake, we get to the end. So I was very nervous writing a book. I didn't know where to start. My book ended up being a memoir, and I didn't really want it to be. I just wanted to give the reader context and say, hey, I literally lived in a trailer in an old cow pasture in my grandparents' backyard in, you know, the poorest state in the country, where we had the highest teen pregnancy, the highest high school dropout, you know, the highest obesity rate, you know, so we have all this stuff stacked against us. And if I'm able to create a life for myself, then you can do it too. That's what I wanted to do. I started writing the book when I was in a really unhealthy relationship, when I was 3 months postpartum after having my youngest son. So I don't recommend writing a book during those times. And it brought up a lot of my past trauma, because I wasn't anticipating that either. I'm talking about my childhood and my dad and my abuse, and it's almost like I was reliving it again. So that was really difficult. But it was fun, and it was exciting, and I didn't sleep for almost a year because of my baby and because of my book baby. No sleep. But once I was done, there was such a sense of joy and accomplishment, and knowing that it lives in people's homes and knowing that it's helped so many people, which was the end goal of what I wanted. I wanted it to help others, has been so rewarding. I don't think I realized the gravity of writing a book and knowing that it exists forever. I didn't really think about that. I was just wanting to like you said, put my long tweets and Instagram posts into kind of a more condensed version without really thinking about what that meant until the finished product.
Well, I love that the beginning of your title is the not so subtle. Mm. Nothing about you is subtle.
Yeah. And you can literally see and smell me from a mile away.
I love it. It's I'm telling you, I'm now your Gucci girl.
Yeah.
When you look at you, I love that you're wearing this cute little white tank top today, and your story is being told on the tattoos that are beautiful and adorning your body. So what was the very first tattoo, and how did you know that this was going to be, or the first tattoo you feel like you want to share?
I'll share my first one.
Because I think that's part of your, when people know you, they know that fire engine red hair, that beautiful alabaster skin, and your tattoos. So they clearly tell a story.
They do. I mean, I have a bunch of really great tattoos and I have a bunch of really crappy tattoos, but that's life. You know, life is good and bad. It's just my some of my bad choices are on me forever, and that's fine. Speaking of bad choices, my first tattoo, I was obsessed. I was 18 years old and I was obsessed with fairies. And you couldn't tell me anything. I loved fairies. And my mom took me to get my first tattoo by this gentleman named Mick, who had just gotten out of prison. And he tattooed like a fairy with not as much clothing as my mom wished the fairy would have had on my shoulder. And I was so proud of it. And I showed everybody that tattoo. And, you know, no one really ever sees it, but the tattoos that I'm most proud of now, I have a few from my grandparents, my grandpa who passed away this year. But the one that gets the most attention are the girls on my arm, because I have, you know, four people who inspired me, who challenged society's beauty standards and who were unapologetic. So it's a reminder for me every time I look down, you know, that there are a lot of really strong folks out there that didn't conform to the rules that society placed out there. And so it's a nice little reminder. And it makes people laugh. A lot of people think that Mae West or Dolly Parton is my mom or my grandma. And so I just usually let them think it. I'm like, yeah, Dolly Parton's my grandma. That's the name of my next book, should be.
So for our viewers at home that are listening, paint a picture of some of their exquisite faces that adorn your body. So besides Mae West and Dolly Parton, there's some other famous faces that adorn you.
Yep, I have Miss Piggy. Miss Piggy was my hero growing up because she was fat and unapologetic and always had a bunch of diamonds on. And not that I could afford diamonds. The only diamonds I've worn still were like loaned to me, but she just represented glamour to me in someone that was in a fat body. And then I have Divine, who was the first drag queen. And, you know, I identify as queer. So that was really important to me, having like a queer icon. And then I have a bunch of ridiculous, I have like a Disneyland tattoo and I have a Dirty Dancing tattoo that I got from my mom. And I thought my mom would be really happy and she was not very happy. I was like, look, mom, I got a Patrick Swayze tattoo for you. And she's like, well, I love Patrick Swayze, but I don't want him tattooed on you. So yeah, but I have a lot of fun tattoos.
I love that you have strutted your stuff at New York Fashion Week, and you've changed that dialogue. It used to be what I would imagine emaciated, underfed, Amazons. You know, women who are too thin and too tall. That's not a sample size that most of us wear. That size 0 or size 2. When you showed up at New York Fashion Week and you saw some of those iconic supermodels, what was the exchange like? Because I know they're now your friends and you have evolved to having these incredible relationships. But did they also have body shaming as kids? Were they too thin, too tall to fit in with kids? And did they too get bullied?
So when I first started modeling, someone told me that the saying is that actors or actresses are like prom queens in high school and that models are like the kids that were shoved into lockers. And, you know, some of my friends that are models have very famous parents and so they're very beautiful and they became models that way. But most of my friends had very similar backgrounds to mine. They didn't come from, you know, really well-off families. They were bullied a lot in school for their looks because a lot of my friends that are models have what most people consider unconventional looks, and which it's nice. Over the past few years, there's been a lot of normalizing beauty across the board, no matter, you know, your size, shape, ethnicity, all of that. So, Yeah, there's a lot of disordered eating in the modeling community. There's a lot of bullying and shame within the community, but also, you know, that we bring into from our own childhood. But I have met some of my best friends through the industry because they understand what you're going through. They understand how you feel. They understand what it's like to have, you know, the rejection. So there's, you know, there's a sense of camaraderie there that most people wouldn't understand.
I love whenever when you felt like you needed to take a stance, you go big or you go home. You have helped create boycotts. There was a moment in time where you were going to go after the Facebooks,
yes,
and the Instagrams and the Tumblrs. So what is it like for you when you have a cause, you believe in fighting for that cause, and then you find that you have followers that follow suit?
Well, I mean, I think I try to be more mindful of the causes I take on now because people can be very passionate online, and I want to make sure that that passion is channeled appropriately. But there have definitely been times that I have called out, you know, Facebook for removing images of plus size bodies in bathing suits and not removing, you know, more slender frames, because Facebook viewed it as unhealthy. And it's challenging that and saying, like, these are people just existing. And, you know, if you're going to have ridiculous standards, then it needs to apply to everyone and not just a group. So, you know, I think that change is possible. It takes a lot of work, and it's not just one person. It's a group of, it's a collective. And I don't believe in being quiet when people are being mistreated and marginalized communities are suffering. So yeah, I've always had a big mouth, and if I can put it to use to helping other people, then I'm gonna do that.
I've been in my pajamas, yes, for the better part of 6 months.
Same.
And I love that in the middle of a COVID crisis, you were able to stand up and speak out. So many of us saw you at the Grammys with that beautiful, sparkly strawberry dress. Mm-hmm. And then we go on lockdown, and TikTok does this whole trend of the strawberry dress. Mm-hmm. And I love that you decided at home, probably in your PJs too, because it's COVID.
No, I was sitting in the dress. No, I'm kidding. Okay.
Sitting in that gorgeous strawberry dress. For those that don't know TikTok, for those that missed you walking on the red carpet at the Grammys, describe why you needed to say something. And you did so publicly and loudly so. And those of us in our PJs were rooting you on.
That post I did about the dress got more attention than like my Cosmopolitan cover, than really any of my work, which I was surprised about. But also it plays into a larger problem, which was that the dress that I wore, you know, I'm trying to remember when all this came out. So it was about 6 months prior I had worn this dress to the Grammys, you know. A lot of people told me how beautiful I looked, but online later, on Instagram, my inbox was flooded of every fashion account you can think of posting, you know, my look along with other celebrities that had gone to the Grammys, and people could rate it. And everyone was saying how horrible I looked. And, you know, there was a lot of positivity, don't get me wrong. I felt like a princess, and there were a lot of people that agreed. But there were also a lot of people that made fun of me and said, you know, how it wasn't appropriate that I wore that dress to the Grammys and all kinds of stuff. And then later, you know, people that are slender popularized the dress on TikTok, and it all of a sudden was like the dress to have. And so that's when I went online and said, I find it ironic that I wore this dress, you know, 6 months prior, and everyone, you know, was shaming me for wearing it. But then slender folks on TikTok popularize it, and it's all of a sudden like the must-have dress. And it wasn't me wanting credit for being the first person to wear it, because I didn't care about that. It was just the fact that society treats plus size bodies like we aren't fashionable, like we don't matter, like we're invisible. And I wanted to highlight that discrepancy. And when I did, a lot of people chimed in saying, we've seen it, it's happened to us, we get it. And so, and I had a lot of really great conversations after. So, you know, I hope that it goes towards shifting things towards people being more mindful. But, you know, I'm definitely used to being a plus size person and being overlooked in fashion. It's unfortunately nothing new.
But I love that you're not going anywhere.
No,
I love
I'm
that
not.
You're not backing down.
No.
So if you were to fundamentally change the fashion industry, how and why and when could we see some change? Because clearly it needs it. Mm.
I mean, I think I already have changed in a lot of ways, along with a lot of my colleagues, but there's still a lot of change. I think the only way that there's going to be real, actual, lasting change is outside of the fashion industry. There is a problem in the fashion industry, but the issue isn't within fashion. It's within society. It's the multi-billion dollar diet industry that feeds off of the fact that so many people don't love themselves, but so many people don't love themselves because diet industries and companies have told them that they can't love themselves because of how they look. And so unless we dismantle those systems where people are profiting from our self-hate that has literally been sold to us, then it's really hard to change the overall problem. So the only way we can do it is for parents and teachers such as yourself telling, you know, their children, you know, I know that you might be feeling this way, but it has nothing to do with your, you know, inner worth, your physical appearance, anything like that. And reaffirming how they feel, loving ourselves, loving others, and trying to show compassion to others and understanding that none of us look the same. That's a great thing. We're not supposed to look the same or act the same or be the same, and that there is strength and power in being yourself.
You're so positive. You're so self-aware, and your self-esteem is amazing. And I want you to envision a 10-year-old girl in some trailer in some small town who's listening to this podcast and sees himself in you. What could you tell that sweet little 10-year-old girl to do, to be, and to hang on?
I mean, I'm a firm believer that, you know, you are capable of great things regardless of your physical appearance or your circumstances. You know, I had really big dreams, and I was told over and over my entire life that none of them were possible. And you know, by me following my dreams and making my dreams a reality, which meant being uncomfortable, which meant leaving my family behind and creating my own path for myself, I was able to open up an entire world for myself that I didn't know I needed or existed. So I think it's important, you know, especially as a young kid, to remember that your home life might not be great. It might be really scary, but it gets better. And you have to believe in yourself enough and stick it out, which I know is cliche because trust me, I've been the kid hiding in your closet from your dad. I've been that kid who didn't want to go to school because people were being mean to me. And I know that now you can't really escape bullying. It follows you online. And I know how hard all of that is, but there was something inside of me that just knew that it gets better. And so reminding kids that it gets better and that this isn't forever, you know, this is such a small part of your life and the best is yet to come. It gets better.
For Tess Holliday, the .. best is yet to come. So if you could actualize the next round of dreams, maybe it's to be on this cover or to walk in this show or to be on this runway. What are some of those dreams that are yet to come, because truly the best is yet to come.
Mm-hmm. I think for me, a lot of my dreams now, I've done a lot in my career that I love and that I'm really proud of, but a lot of my dreams now are personal. I'm really focused on healing my trauma for myself and for my kids. I'm really focused on writing another book, working on my podcast, having a healthy, loving relationship that doesn't hurt me. So, and that will happen when it's supposed to happen. But I'm really excited to just work on myself. And ultimately, working on myself will just make any, you know, career choice or anything that I'm working on better, because that's where the real work is. So I've spent the last decade giving myself to others and working so much on my professional growth that I neglected my personal growth. And so I'm just really excited. COVID has really impacted people in a lot of ways. And for me, it was really hard in the beginning, but I realized that I have a lot of internal work that I didn't have time to do because I was constantly on airplanes and on sets, and now I'm not. So, you know, I'm going to focus on myself. So I'm excited, but professionally, I would love to still be on, you know, a high fashion cover and doing high fashion. But if that's not my path, then I'm okay with that.
I'm so grateful to our guest, Tess Holliday, for opening up and showing everyone the importance of self-love. My dear listeners, may each of us create a world in which everyone is accepted, regardless of their appearance. May we work towards ending unfair and unrealistic standards of any kind. And in honor of our guest, Tess Holliday, may we all say F your beauty standards and love each other for who we are. That concludes our show this week. Thank you so much for listening. Once again, I'm your host, Erin Gruwell. This episode was produced and edited by Matt Martin Hall and Rob Falk. Until next time, dear listeners, may you write what needs to be written and tell what needs to be told.